And good evening and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio. I want to get right to our guest today. We only have him for about 27 minutes now. And it's a topic that I think a lot of people are talking about these days. I know it's come up a number of times just for me in the last couple of months. Our guest today is John Bursch. He serves as the Vice President of Appellate Advocacy for the Alliance Defending Freedom, the largest public interest law firm in the world defending religious liberty, free speech, parental rights, marriage and family, and the right to life. John has argued 12 cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, including cases defending the Catholic Church's teachings on marriage and sexuality. He speaks frequently to groups, both religious and secular, about topics including marriage, human sexuality, the right to life, and religious liberty. He's a married father of five and also a fourth-degree Knight of Columbus, a three-time past president of the Grand Rapids Legatus Chapter, and a member of the Pro-Life Partners Foundation Advisory Board. John Bursch, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Terrific to be here.
And we get a number of guests that come to us through Sophia Institute, and the book that John has written is called Loving God's Children, the Church and Gender Ideology, again, published by Sophia Institute, available at Sophia's website, also available here in the Philadelphia market at the St. Jude shop. Stop in and buy it there. If they don't have it in stock, they can get it for you pretty quickly, as they deal a lot with Sophia. So, John, we only had a minute to chat before we got together live here, and I think that this book is very timely, especially for me in light of some conversations I've had recently. I mentioned to you I had an opportunity to speak at a retreat about a month ago, and you know, a concerned father that came up to me after, and we were talking about his son that had recently come out, if you will, and let the world know that he's homosexual. I also have another friend who has a son that's transitioning, and it just seems to be happening more and more. And when it's not in your immediate world, it's kind of like, yeah, it's out there. But when you talk to some of the people that are in the throes of this, it can be heartbreaking. So I think the book is timely, and I want to thank you for your efforts.
Well, thank you. And for me, it was a natural outgrowth of the work that I do as a religious liberty lawyer, where increasingly when it came to gender ideology, I saw individual rights being violated, you know, first in the context of privacy spaces at schools, like locker rooms, restrooms, showers, then in overnight shelters and prisons. Then we saw it spread and expand into women's sports, where you had boys identifying as girls winning multiple state track and field titles in Connecticut and other places. Then it was the compulsion to use preferred pronouns at work and how that affected employees. And then finally, just most recently, these disastrous policies at school where they're transitioning kids and keeping it a secret from their parents. Just unbelievable. And so in the course of all that work, I did a lot of scientific research and worked with experts to learn more about gender ideology and also learned about the church's teachings about the human body and human sexuality. And it all came together in a book that I'm hoping for those families that have kids who are struggling or might know a family member who's struggling with gender dysphoria, everything they need to know, A to Z, about the subject, how the church wants us to think about it, and what the loving response is when that child comes to you and says, hey, I think I might be the opposite sex.
Yeah, and I as a father of four, all in the two in their 20s, two in their 30s, one soon to be 40. And like I said, I've not been faced with it directly in my own family, but you know, when this does come out and the response, and the normal response, and you being a father as well, you know, you want to love our kids, and we will love them no matter what, but how do you do what's best for them? Because you know, the information that's not always out there, and you talk in the first chapter about what is truth, and you know, we only get one side of the story, that you know, these kids are, and not even kids, older people are in whether it's psychological torment or, you know, whatever it is that's feeding this idea that if I become the other sex, that my life is going to be a whole lot better. But they don't get the other side of the story from those that have already tried to do this and learn that that wasn't the answer. And so trying to get the truth out there and what really is the truth. And I think that that's where your approach in the book and going back to what the Catholic Church teaches, you know, it just lays it out. And I think that the greatest thing, obviously, is that God created us, man and woman. And, you know, he didn't do it by accident. And he didn't create people, I don't think, accidentally created them as the incorrect sex.
Well, one of the things that the church teaches is that we are not just souls trapped in an apparatus that we call the body, that we are embodied souls. And so our body says something about who we are, about who our person is. And we all understand that intuitively, because if someone hits us, we don't say, "Hey, you struck my body." We say, "You hit me." We all understand that there's a connection there between our body and ourselves. And that was the whole purpose of the incarnation as well. You know, Jesus Christ took on human form. He became a body, embodied. And at the end of the Gospels, when he had been crucified, died, and then resurrected again, he still had a body. It was a glorified body, and he could do things with his body that we could not. But it was important that the apostles understood that it was a body they could still touch. They could feel the marks in his hands and in his side. It was a body that could still eat. He ate in front of them, on multiple occasions, right there in the upper room the very first time he saw them. But again, when they had him he had them on the seashore, and he asked Peter three times if he loved him. You know, so that embodiment is really important. And Pope Francis has spoken beautifully about that, about the body as gift. And if we reject the gift of the body, it severs the two most basic commandments, to love God and to love others, because we're rejecting the gift God gave us. We're taking control for ourselves, what we think we should be, instead of accepting God's will for our life. But it also makes it impossible for us to have authentic relationships with other people, because we're not being truthful about who we are. And so we can't love neighbor the way that God asks us to. So understanding those basic concepts about the church teaching, you know, then we can start exploring the science and things like that. And it turns out, like is always the case, those are remarkably aligned.
Yeah, and so you cover this incrementally through the book and take people through the process. In the email exchange we had, you know, I said we could probably talk about this for a couple hours when we only have a few minutes. And again, the book is Loving God's Children, the Church and Gender Ideology. I encourage you to go out and pick this up. We are in the Philadelphia market, John, and I see that one of your one of the praises you got was from our own Archbishop Charles Chaput, and he concludes a nice write-up here by saying, "I look forward to John giving us similar books regarding the other controverted and sensitive moral issues of our time," and this is certainly one of them. So, you know, the church today, and sometimes we get some mixed signals, but obviously the church teaching as it is today has not changed, at least since the last time I checked, is that, you know, we're created man and woman, and that you know, that's the way things are to remain. And you talked about that in how the body is critical in that. What does the scientific community have to say?
Well, the science is crystal clear, and we have this problem that the American medical community is ignoring most of it. First, there is no scientific study anywhere that shows that a man can be born in a woman's body or vice versa, or that a man can be born in a body that is both male and female, or neither male nor female, or some combination thereof. It just doesn't exist. This is a mental health issue. And there are other dysphorias that have to do with other things besides gender and sex a dysphoria being where there's some disconnect between your mind and reality. And one that everyone can relate to, many of us know someone who struggled with this, is anorexia. And that's when a person has this feeling, that a really intense feeling, that they're too fat. And yet the objective reality is that they're not. They could be wasting away. And no doctor, no loving family member would ever encourage an anorexic person to eat less to make their body conform to their mind, or to have surgery so that they could be thinner to conform to their mind. Same with body dysmorphia, which is another mental health issue where someone feels like a part of their body doesn't belong there. And again, it can cause intense distress, but we would never say, yeah, go ahead and take off your arm, or help them do that, because we understand that's not helpful. And it turns out it's the same way with this gender dysphoria. We know that with adolescents and teenagers, that if they were just left to their own devices and not affirmed in their dysphoria, that 80 to 95% of them will just naturally desist from the dysphoria. They'll align their mind with their body. And yet of those same kids, if they are encouraged to start embracing the dysphoria by affirming their pronouns, by affirming their decision to dress like a different sex, to use the other sex as privacy facilities and sports teams and so on, there's a nearly 100% chance they'll go on to taking puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and then eventually getting surgery to try to change their body permanently. And science tells us that changing the body in that way doesn't actually do anything, because every cell in your body will still tell anybody who looks at it, any scientist, whether you're male or female. It's immutable. It cannot be changed. And so what do we find when we look at the long-term studies of individuals who go through those treatments? Well, it increases mental health problems as soon as you get on the puberty blockers. And for those adults who have gone through the entire regimen and they have tried to transition, in the short term, there may be some modest psychological benefits. But if you look at the long term, it's the exact opposite. Suicide rates, which are already shockingly high, get even higher. It goes from 11 times the general population to 17 times the general population, also increasing our other incidents of mental health problems. You have problems with bone density, you have problems with heart disease, you have problems with ordinary development, and then, of course, lack of fertility and loss of sexual function, which is permanent. And so you have this whole class now of individuals. They're known as detransitioners. These are people who initially tried to transition to a different sex and then realized that was a mistake and detransitioned back to their natal sex. And they'll tell you that they get rushed into these procedures. As soon as they express any dysphoria, they're immediately prescribed the pills, and then they're encouraged to continue down that path instead of giving them mental health treatment, which is what they really need. Because in most of these cases with gender dysphoria, there's some underlying issue that needs to be dealt with, whether that's, you know, sexual abuse or a grandmother who dressed the child up as the opposite sex, bullying, or some other thing that's taken place. And so you're not getting to the root cause. You're just treating cosmetically the stuff on the outside, which ultimately isn't going to make a difference. And so when we hear things like, would you rather have a live daughter or a dead son, or vice versa, and those are just lies. Lies that people tell. And in the meantime, the kids, they're being encouraged through TikTok and Instagram and other social media platforms to go down this path, and they're embraced and they're popular and everything seems great when they pursue that. But no one tells them about all the adverse effects on the back end of this. And the thing that haunts me, and hopefully will haunt everybody who's listening to this and will cause them to go out and go through everything and then realize they made a mistake and then come back and say, why didn't you tell me? You know, if you had any opportunity to learn about this, why didn't you tell me that all these terrible things were going to happen and that there was another path that I could have chosen, one that relied on psychotherapy as opposed to these physical changes? So it's just critically important that we understand that whole gamut of the science so that we can communicate that truth in a loving way. And that loving portion is really critical in two ways, as we address in the book. First, love is not some emotion, some sappy thing like you see in the movies. The Catholic Church tells us that love is willing the best of the other. And so willing the best of the other oftentimes does not mean giving in to what they say they want or what they desire. It means doing and speaking in a way that will result in the best outcome for them. And if we know that the outcome of a gender transition results in so much pain and heartache, then it's our responsibility to tell them the truth about that and try to guide them in a different course. The other thing is that this is a very serious mental health diagnosis, and there are people suffering from gender dysphoria who have enormous distress. And so to truly love them as family members, as neighbors, as brothers and sisters in Christ, we need to be in relationship with them, we need to accompany them, and do everything that we can to try to help them. And so it's critically important that we not shy away from this issue because we're uncomfortable about it or don't understand it. Instead, we need to lean into it in truth so that we can help get these individuals to a better place. And that's what God is calling us to do.
Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, in the involvement that you've had through the Alliance Defending Freedom and the issues with, you know, something as simple as a bathroom in an elementary school, and you know, as serious as the involvement in sports that we saw first with the state of Connecticut and the track and field here locally in the Philadelphia market. Of course, we had the swimmer at University of Pennsylvania, and all that went on there. So, you know, it not only impacts the people that struggle with gender dysphoria, but when they go through this process, it starts to hurt a lot of other people as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, anytime that we depart from God's plan, which is just sin, simply put, it has an impact on others. And C.S. Lewis talks about this beautifully. I think it's in Mere Christianity, where he says that all of us together are like a fleet of sailing ships. And if one of the ships starts to drift off course, it will naturally have an impact on the other ships around it. It's just the way that it goes. And so when we think about sin being private, there is no such thing. You know, even sins that seem private, like watching pornography or masturbation, can have a terrible impact on those around us, causes us to withdraw socially and not be able to have authentic relationships and things like that. And so that's certainly true here. These cases that I kind of gave reference to, I mean, it's easy to see in those types of cases how other people are impacted. When the girl who actually was the fastest girl in Connecticut lost the state championship because there were two boys who finished ahead of her identifying as girls, but she's obviously harmed by that psychologically, by the loss of recognition. Sometimes it can impact college recruiting and scholarships and things like that. You know, that's easy to see. When someone at a workplace is forced to use a preferred pronoun when they believe that to be a lie and that violates their religious beliefs. You know, again, it's easy to see how that person is harmed. Even in the situation with the school where there's that secret transition, I mean, talk about a harm to those parents and the family. But even leaving aside all those things, there are harms to relationships too. Gender ideology is being used as a wedge between siblings, between kids and their parents. I've seen this with folks that I know. It's really sad and unfortunate where, you know, someone wants to transition and some family members want to support them because they, without knowing the scientific evidence and other things, you know, are just giving into their stated desire. While others who know the truth and have studied it are resisting that and trying to slow the process down. Well, that causes all kinds of inner family conflicts and loss of harmony and things like that. And it can go so far that in a state like California, you can actually lose custody of your child if you're not willing to affirm them. You talk about a harm to lose that relationship with your son or daughter entirely, all because of some state official's misguided sense of what it means to love. So there are just multiple ways that people can be hurt. And even aside from those direct impacts, there's kind of an indirect impact on society right now, too, where those who are studying this issue and are trying to be purveyors of the truth are being shut down and bullied and just really shunned from the public square altogether for trying to speak the truth. You know, it's the worst of our moral relativism, dictatorial culture, especially online, where people can lose their job or they can lose their reputation, they can lose friends, all because they're trying to speak the truth. So any sin has all kinds of ripple effects on everybody around them, but that's particularly true with respect to those who pursue gender ideology.
So, again, our guest today is John Bursch, and the book we're talking about is Loving God's Children, The Church and Gender Ideology, published by Sophia Institute Press, available at Sophia's website, locally here in the Philadelphia market. Head over to the St. Jude shop, and they can get it for you. You know, the truth is out there, John, and I have to believe that the folks that promote this know that the truth is out there, that there is a truth, and that what they're recommending to children, young adults, that they know, they have to know that in the long run, that this is not a good thing. I heard one person speak about a motive the other day, and I'm still thinking over it, that they're using this as a driver to bring about socialized medicine, where they're, because I think one of the things that you'll see in people that either continue to try to transition or detransition, that a lot of them are going to need medical care for the rest of their lives, and that the cost is going to be such a burden that this could be help them, you know, drive those that are looking for socialized medicine, that they'll use these folks as examples of people that they need so much care for the rest of their lives that they can never afford to do it on their own. And I don't know that's so much accurate, but there's, like you said, that the truth is out there. You don't have to go very far to find it. What do you think is the motivation of the people that are in this market, if you will? Because I'm sure that there's money to be made and what have you in helping people to transition. But is there a motive that you've come across in looking at this in depth?
Well, I think there's lots of different motives, and they are different for different people. So, for example, if you're a parent and at a doctor's insistence you allowed your child to transition, you will probably forever be a pro-gender ideology advocate. I mean, it would just be natural, because if you would ever admit to yourself that what you did caused irreversible harm to your child, you'd never be able to live with yourself. You know, so those parents, even if they were just bamboozled at the beginning, you know, are almost locked into believing what they've been told, because otherwise it would just be devastating to themselves psychologically. For the medical professionals, yes, there's a huge profit motive. Planned Parenthood now, we all know how much revenue they generate from abortions. Their fastest growing area of revenue, it appears to be, comes from prescribing the puberty blockers and the cross-sex hormones. Becoming a huge business for them, and they've got a financial interest in perpetuating it. Even more so for some of the gender transition clinics that are popping up. 10 years ago, it was almost impossible to find one. Now there are hundreds of them. Well, with an average surgery around $70,000, there's big money to be had there. And because of court lawsuits and pressure and things like that, lots of companies and government agencies are providing sex transition coverage as part of their health insurance. And so that's all paid for by a big pocket. And so they've got an incentive to keep that going. Then you look at the politicians. You know, there's a whole political party which is completely devoted to LGBTQ rights, and they feel like this is an opportunity that they can hit the other side over the head with something to try to show that they're not compassionate, that they don't care about people, that they discriminate, that they're bigots, you know, all those lies. And they're going to continue to push it because their motive is power. They want to retain or obtain political office. So you can just see, as you go through these different groups, they may have different motivations, but they're all wrongly motivated because they're not truly loving. They're not looking out for the best interests of the people who are most affected by this.
Very good. We have just about 2 minutes left, John. I know you need to leave us when we take the break at the bottom of the hour. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention before you have to go?
Well, I really hope people will sit down with the book and take time with it. Again, it's Loving God's Children, The Church and Gender Ideology, available through Sophia Institute Press. It sounds like some Catholic bookstores there in Philadelphia, major online book resellers as well, although we encourage you to use the Catholic sources. In addition to some of the things that we've been talking about, just to give you a sense of what's in the book, the very last chapter is the longest one, chapter 10. And it takes a number of really common questions and provides common sense answers to them, frequently with direct quotations to documents that have been authored by church officials, some by Pope Francis, some by the Vatican, many by the bishops here in the United States. And they're questions like, what do I do if my son or daughter comes to me and they say that they think they're a different sex, or if a family member would do the same? What do I do if my employer wants to make me wear an ally pin, or if I have to use compelled pronouns? What if a transgender person comes to me as a priest or a director of catechesis at the parish, and they want to enter into a Catholic sacramental marriage at my church? It just kind of goes one by one through all those things and provides really detailed instructions and places for additional resources, so that this really can be your one-stop shop for all of your questions about gender ideology. My hope is that at the end of it, you'll be able to take everything which is described in very simple language. You don't have to be a lawyer, a doctor, to be able to, or even a theologian, to understand all these concepts. And then you'll be able to take those things and communicate them as truth to others, because it's only by going individual by individual that we will be able to ultimately stop this ideology from spreading and harming people.
Yeah, especially as you mentioned, in today's climate, where if you speak out against it, that not only do you get canceled on the social media platforms and those types of things, but you get canceled within your own family, within your own circle of friends, and what have you.
Yep.
So a serious, very serious topic today, and a book well written for those that may find themselves face to face with having to deal with this issue. John, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today and enlightening all of us on the church's teaching and how we can help to combat this gender ideology. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation. This was great. God bless you and the show.
All righty. Thank you, John. For our listeners, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have the gospel from Mass today. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This is Dr. Carol Houghton of the Diocese of Harrisburg. I have been blessed in many ways by Kathleen McCarthy's retreats, days of reflection, preaching, and teaching, especially on In His Sign Catholic Radio. When Kathleen teaches from the Scripture and shares with us her personal stories, I am deeply touched and inspired. It is as if God is speaking directly from her heart to my heart. And when Kathleen reads from her books, In the Silence of My Heart, she shares with us what God has spoken to her, an intimate message of unconditional love and mercy. God has blessed Kathleen with many gifts, which she readily shares with others, by doing every day what the Lord has asked of her. And by the example of her yes to God, we too are encouraged to give our yes to God. For Kathleen's daily and public witness to the gospel, I will be forever grateful. For it is by this example that she challenges me to become a better disciple of the Lord.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We often think of the scripture where the disciples were walking to Emmaus, where they said, "Were not our hearts burning within us as Jesus spoke to us on the road?" As we travel along the road together in our Archdiocese of Philadelphia and Camden Diocese, we thank God for our loyal circle of family and friends. Please consider sponsoring one of our new programs in the name of your parish priest, family member, or friend. It would be a beautiful way of helping us to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, our risen Lord. Give us a call at 610-527-2906 or visit us on the web at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. Your host, Ken Johnston. And I, too, want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that allows me to do these shows each Wednesday. And I am grateful for that, something I never thought in my life that I would be doing. And it just goes to show, you know, what God can do with any of us if we let Him. Open our hearts, our minds, our souls to Him, and it can become rather exciting to see what He's got in store for us next. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to be able to do this, like I say, each and every Wednesday. We had a guest that was supposed to join us in the 5:30 segment, but unfortunately she took ill and is not able to join us today. So I thought we would kick off this segment with the gospel from Mass today. And it's taken from Matthew chapter 11. It's just three short verses, verses 28 to 30. And it reads, Jesus said to the crowds, "Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves. For my yoke is easy and my burden light." And the gospel of the Lord, and praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ. And we talked about this a bit this morning at our contemplative prayer group that we have down in Our House Ministries in Grace Ferry on Wednesday mornings at 9:30. And then we have Mass at 10:30. And we read the gospel the night before and then a couple of times in the hour and reflect on it. And it was all this talk about yokes, and all I could think was, you know, for my yoke is easy. And it's like, yeah, I like my yokes over easy. And, you know, this idea of eggs kept coming to me. And but anyway, you know, being somebody that, you know, thought they had all the answers and was going to make my way through life and was going to do it without God. And then to come to realize that, you know, the only way I was going to survive was through a relationship with God. And then 30 years later to read this gospel and look at it, and it's like, man, why didn't I get this when I was 15? All the aggravation it could have saved me over the next 15 years, and, you know, in some ways still paying for it until today. And it is, when we look at it, and, you know, even our guest in the 5 o'clock hour and talking about gender ideology and the lengths that we'll go to in order to try and find some happiness and joy. And even when we spend all kinds of money, have all kinds of surgeries to try to transition, when we buy all kinds of clothes and cars and houses, when we do all these things that we think are going to bring us happiness, and yet it's fleeting. It's here today, gone tomorrow, you know, here at 4 o'clock and gone at 5 o'clock. Sometimes it really is that quick, and that it's only in Jesus Christ, it's only in God that we're going to get that eternal joy. And that eternal joy starts and can start now. You know, I delayed it for, you know, decades, thinking that I could figure out a way to manufacture my own happiness and my own joy. And so what is it when Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves"? What is that yoke that Jesus wants to place on us? It sounds like a negative term at first glance. that nobody wants a yoke put on them. But when we realize what that yoke is, and again, we talked about that this morning, you know, if you have a couple head of cattle, you know, a couple oxen, and you put the yoke over both and they work together, you have more power than you would have on your own. And so while for the farmer in this example, it certainly makes the cattle, the oxen, easier to control, and probably the only way to control them and to have them do the job that they want to do, I think Jesus uses this example because obviously when he says that it's easy and it's light, that it's not a burden, and that, you know, we shouldn't look at it as a burden. But what is it? And for those that listen every week, and especially on the last Wednesday of the month when we have our Divine Will, the Gift of the Divine Will discussion with Peter DePalma and the guests that he brings along, you know, that yoke is God's will. And, you know, I'm sure that there's people out there that somewhere along the line got this without having to be go through all kinds of trials and tribulations, although nobody gets gets out of this world unscathed. We're all going to suffer trials sooner or later. But for those that have suffered them and succumbed and looked to other methods, it just made it worse. And, you know, it's so much easier to look back in hindsight. And I remember my father years ago, when I was in my 20s, you know, tell me, you know, if I could just put my, you know, a 40-year-old head on a 20-year-old shoulders, what a difference it would make. And yet I continued to beat my head against the wall for another 10 years and come to learn that the primary way, the only way to get real joy, to get real satisfaction, is to try to live God's will. And for the last 30 years, I've tried to do that, where, pray on a regular basis and look for opportunities throughout the day. I've come to learn that they're called signal graces, to look for those little graces that God puts right in front of you, where he's asking you to do something. And, do we choose to do it, or do we choose to ignore it and do something else instead that we think is going to bring us that joy, bring us that happiness? And I know, even as late as this week, you know, signal graces that would come, and it's like, gotcha, God, but not right now. I'll get to that. And then I don't get to it. And, you know, and I'm relatively, I think, clear-headed now, and I'd like to think that for the most part I'm on the beam, and I still struggle with it. And I'm certain that many of our listeners and others struggle even more than I do in responding to God's call, because we think that it's not going to bring us happiness, that it's not going to bring us joy, that, you know, maybe even that we think that God's got an angle and that it's even to make us feel worse than we already feel. And yet it's the furthest thing from the truth. When I look back and those times where I've accepted, you know, God's will for me, and to try to do God's will, and again, that's before I learned that, you know, maybe I can even give up my will completely and try to live God's will, that in hindsight, it's just brought more pain when I try to do it on my own. In those moments when I responded to those signal graces, when I responded to what was right in front of me at any given moment and did what I think God wanted me to do, that's where the joy comes from. But we have to take the time to see it. We're currently in the second week of Advent, and, you know, the readings over the couple of Sundays about being attentive, to be watchful. And for me, this Advent, that's where the concentration has been, not so much in being attentive and watchful for the Lord's coming at Christmas. I mean, the Lord already came 2,000 years ago. We celebrated his coming, but in hindsight, you know, when I look forward to him coming at Christmas, there wasn't a second or third or fourth or fifth coming that has taken place. Maybe it's on Christmas Day that we think about more about his coming and concentrate on it more, and that it moves us spiritually. But in this time of Advent this year, you know, part of that watchfulness, part of that attentiveness has been to look at for those signal graces. What is it that God's asking me to do or calling me to do at any given moment? And how do I respond? You know, one of the gifts of the 12-step program is the 10th step. It's very much like the examine prayer of St. Ignatius Loyola, where we, you know, take time each day to look at our day and reflect on what happened over the course of the last 24 hours. And, you know, what did I do with the time that I was given, and how did I respond to those things that God, you know, placed right in front of me? And I've been doing that for a number of years now, but not looked at it so much as I have recently in terms of this idea of signal graces. These thoughts that come, and, you know, in the past I may have wondered where they come from. I know where they come from now. And it was as simple as coming up the Blue Route from South Philly today on my way to the radio studio and hearing this distinct voice, if you will, or hearing the phrase, you know, pray your precious blood prayers. And my initial reaction was, not right now. I'll have time for that on the way home from the studio. You know, maybe I need to check my messages or do something else. And it was like, no, pray those prayers and pray them now. And I responded to it, and I had about 25 minutes in my time on the Blue Route to pray. And responded appropriately to that signal grace. But I can tell you in all honesty that that's happened a couple of times the last few days, and it was, I'll get to it, and don't. And so this Advent period for me, just in these first couple of weeks, has already been a wake-up call to really pay attention. And I've thought, over the years, especially recent years, that I was pretty good at responding to these calls, but they come in various forms, and I don't know if God's being more active in my life or really wrapping me over the head, putting things right in my face a little bit more today than he was before, perhaps because I wasn't doing everything that I was being asked to do. And that doesn't mean I wasn't doing good things. And it doesn't mean that I wasn't busy. You know, sometimes I wish there were 48 hours in a day to accomplish a lot of the things that I want to accomplish. And they're not necessarily things that God wants me to accomplish. Otherwise, he would give me the time to do all those things. So what is it in your life that God has called you to do? Are there signal graces that you've received? Are there thoughts or words that have come to you, and we've put God off? And, you know, in the 4 o'clock hour, we talk about the saints, and, you know, they didn't put God off. They responded for the most part immediately, and that's why their examples are so great for us, that when that call comes, regardless of what we're doing, what we may be in the middle of, even if we think it's important, that if God's truly calling us to do something, it could be to make a phone call, to say a prayer, to go to Mass, to get the confession, to do whatever it is that God has put right in front of us. It could be a person that crosses our path, who we may view as an interruption to some important task that we really need to get done, when the important thing we need to do is for that person that's right in front of us. I had one earlier today where trying to help out a friend, and I've been primarily doing it through prayer. A number of other people have interacted with the individual directly, and I kind of left it to them, but I got a message earlier today about from a mutual friend who asked how he was doing. And I had to be honest, you know, I could have responded as like, I think he's doing okay, I haven't heard anything, but instead, you know, picked up the phone and made the phone call. And because I would generally wanted to know for myself before I relayed information about, you know, how this guy was doing. And fortunately, he seems to be in a much better spot than he was last week. But I could have chose to ignore the text message, not made the phone call, or even gone so far as to, you know, just generalize and say, yeah, I think he's doing okay because I haven't heard anything bad. But we need to respond, I think, to those promptings. And, you know, the promptings that we get, you know, come, I think, directly from Jesus. Oftentimes we'll use our guardian angel. And for those that are in 12-step programs, we talk about it a lot where it happens for a lot of us through other people that, you know, God may be able to maybe trying to signal us to do something and we're not hearing it, we're not seeing it. And the only way we actually get it is for God to put somebody, you know, directly in our path that happens to mention something. And oftentimes, in my case, they don't even talk directly to whatever it is that I'm being asked to do. It's in thinking about what whatever it is that we're having a conversation about that will eventually direct me to what it is that God has been trying to get me to do. And like I say, when those nights come and I review my day and think about the various thoughts that have come, the people that have come, and my response to them, when it's been the right response, and we know when it's the right response. You know, we can only duck God and avoid him and put it off for so long, but when we respond, we know when we've done the right thing. It's just a sense or an intuition, a feeling of consolation that we get when that happens, when we know that we've done the right thing, that I can put my head on the pillow and know that it was a good day. At the same time, you know, with our conscience, God, you know, we know when we've not responded. We know when we've been asked to do something and we've neglected it or we've not done it to the best of our ability. And we end up paying the price. And one of the gifts of being in recovery and having to do this 10-step review or having to make an examination of conscience, and for those of us that are in recovery, it's not, you know, that we necessarily do it because that's what the church has taught us to do. We do it out of survival mode, because if we allow these things to pile up and accumulate over time, they can get to the, you know, to the point where we're led right back to the whatever it was that we were addicted to, whatever it is that we took solace in order to get by in life when we didn't respond properly. And so those evenings when I go through this process and feel uncomfortable or recognize that there's things that should have been done that weren't, thank God for the opportunity in most cases to be able to do them the next day. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes, you know, it's literally a once in a lifetime opportunity, and not that it's going to bring us a great windfall of cash or anything like that, but a once in a lifetime opportunity where we have an opportunity to help somebody. And maybe, especially in a case where we're uniquely qualified to help that person. And by not answering that call, the opportunity is gone, not only for today, but for all of eternity. And so in this Advent season, in this state of being watchful, of being attentive, you know, what is it that God may be asking you to do this Advent? Is it something that he's been asking you to do for a long time? And maybe now in this season, you recognize it for what it really is and will take action. Will we continue to delay and put it off, maybe hope that somebody else takes care of it or that an easier way to handle it comes along? And brothers and sisters, it's usually not the way it works. The only way to get through it is to literally go through it. And you know, spent time, and I think I may have mentioned this last week, recently, for whatever reason, a bunch of Father Chad Ripperger's talks have been filling up my YouTube feed, And you know, that's where this idea of the signal graces has come from. And what is it that's blocking us from growing in holiness? You know, the other thing that Father Ripperger mentions is our defects, and that those defects block us from growing in holiness. And some of us actually like those defects. And I've, you know, heard people talk about how, you know, if I still have this defect, it must be God's fault. God's, you know, leaving that defect here for a reason. And I start to question that now. I was one of those believers that, especially in a 12-step program where we have a 7-step where we ask God to remove our defects of character. And if I still have those defects, well, then God must not have wanted them removed. And so it's easy to sometimes it's easier to believe that and to continue to live with those defects than it is to actually work on them. And, you know, and one of the best ways to stop a character defect, especially one that's part of a behavioral pattern, is this: just stop doing it. Father McKay mentioned last night in our Calyx meeting about, you know, vulgarity and foul language. And, you know, you can pray to God and ask God to remove that from you, that defect that lies within you that causes you to still use that language. Or you can just stop using it. And, you know, it for me, it was interesting because I was, you know, one who used that kind of language for quite a while. And somewhere along the line, it just stopped. And it's interesting to me because I don't think it's a sin. I've confessed it, but oftentimes, you know, when you curse in your own mind, it's kind of weird because you'll use vulgarity or whatever you want in your thoughts, but I seldom verbalize them. And I think it's pretty cool where I've had people actually come up to me after I've given a talk, especially in a 12-step room, and you know, they'll mention to me, you know, that was great, and you didn't use any vulgarity. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of intentional. I don't want to use that language anymore. And I'll be honest, I now find it offensive, and I know that it offends other people, and they've told me how it offends them. And so, you know, I don't want to offend God. I don't want to offend them by using it. But if we just sit back and think that God's going to somehow or other remove that from us, and all of a sudden we're going to become, you know, the golden tongue, St. John Chrysostom, and not use it anymore, I think we're mistaken, that we have to make a conscious effort to just stop using it. And I think the same thing applies to a lot of the other defects that we may struggle with. And one of the things that I hadn't heard before that I did hear from Father Ripperger was that one of the key components to learn what those defects are is to ask Our Lady of Sorrows, that in prayer to ask Our Lady of Sorrows to point out, you know, which defect it is that we need to address. And, you know, for folks that are in recovery, you know, when we first start on a decent path and on the road to recovery, we can be loaded with all kinds of defects. And over time, I think we start to shed some of them. God removes a bunch of them. And yet we're still human, and we still have them. And I know for me that those defects, we may think we have one defect, and it's really hiding a deeper defect and something else that needs to be taken a look at and brought into the light, so that it can be so that it can be overcome. And so this time of the year, this Advent season, much like the Lenten season, is a time of preparation, a time that our church in all its wisdom sets aside for us to maybe focus on these things. And again, this time of Advent, where it's to be attentive, to be watchful, is to spend even more, not necessarily more time, because we only have so much time, but to pay more attention as to what is going on in our lives at every moment. How much time are we wasting on things that are of no benefit, not only to ourselves, but to anyone else. How much time are we spending in prayer? Is God asking us to do things, and we're either not hearing it or hearing it and delaying? And I can't be more thankful today for the gift of at least the knowledge that these things exist. There's so many people walking around, it's pretty obvious that either aren't aware or don't care. And that's why the world is the way it is today. So by paying attention and doing what God is asking us to do, we can make not only our world, but everybody else's world just a little bit better. So I want to thank you once again for being with us on this Wednesday. Hopefully it was as beneficial to you as it was to me. I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. It'll be our last one before we celebrate Christmas. And so I continue to pray for you and ask that you pray for me as we draw closer and closer to the celebration of our Lord's birth in just 12 days. So until next Wednesday, my prayer is that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care.